Lately, there's been a lot of interesting discourse around different modeling strategies. And today, I wanted to answer the question, can UML make your stand-ups more efficient, or do you have to use CRC cards for that? That's obviously not what we're actually talking about today. I don't know if anyone has been on LinkedIn lately, but they've been doing a thing where they show AI-generated questions and then try and get experts to answer them. But largely in my feed, the only experts engaging with these things are ones making fun of how little sense the questions make. The most recent one in my feed being, how can you design a web development framework that supports lifelong learning and personal growth? Not really sure that's a web framework design consideration, but sure, whatever. Anyway, today, in our first episode, we have Byron Alley, a good friend of mine who has been coming to a meetup that I run here in Victoria for quite some time and trying to steal people off to his own functional programming meetup. I thought he'd be a really good person to have on because he's got an interesting, similar background to mine, but he's been doing software a little bit longer and has a bit more of a focus on functional programming. So thought we could talk a little bit about the current state of TDD discourse. Hey, Byron, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jared, how you doing?
I'm doing good. I wanted to have you on the show because of your unique perspective. You've never written a single unit test in your life. You believe tests are for programmers that make mistakes and think we should all just get it right the first time. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I mean, like, basically, I mean, you know, I don't know what's with other people who make mistakes when they write code, but like, I just figure you write, you know, you think about the problem for 2 minutes and then you write the code uninterruptedly in one burst of genius, and then you're done forever. Like,
I'm so surprised you waste 2 whole minutes on it, but that's
yeah. But so I guess we talked about when you talked about starting a podcast, we talked about how there are a couple of things that you and I talk about on a regular basis at the Open Hack, regular meetup that you've been running for years now. Actually, you've been in charge of it for a number of years, right?
Yeah, about 5 years or something like that.
Yeah, it's a pretty long time in tech terms. I mean, that's like what, like 300 JavaScript frameworks or
yeah,
what?
Something like that.
But yeah, so definitely TDD was one of the things that we talked about, and I guess I should offer like a proper intro. I mean, I've been, much like you, I've been programming since I was roughly 10 years old. We have that in common. I'm a bit older, but you know, the same kind of theme. What was different for me was I started off in software and then I did a fade out of software for a while, and my hobby of swing dancing became, you know, something I ran businesses doing for a number of years, and then I did kind of a fade back in. So you know, it's funny, for people who met me when I was running dance studios, you know, it might seem weird, but it was weirder for me to get into the dancing thing. It was, you know, yeah, very much like I'm a tech guy, and this is all the stuff that I'm bad at and uncomfortable with. So, so I was going to say, I'm a software developer. I like to, lately I've been enamored of Elixir. I've gotten more and more into functional programming, and I've kind of been all over the board with technologies. I've used a lot of different ones. But the thing you said about, you know, getting it right the first time and, you know, not making mistakes, it actually took me back to a project I did years ago doing a CMS and event management system that I wrote, you know, in a very quick amount of time. I wrote it in the first version in like a few days, in PHP and, you know, SQL. And literally, like at that point, even though I'd you know, already been introduced to TDD, I banged it out, no unit tests. And it basically, yeah, it did work. Like, honestly, it did basically work for years. So it's not that it's impossible, but maybe, you know, as we go on, we can, you know, we can talk about the reasons why, despite the fact that I know you can, I know you can do it, but I still think that, you know, TDD is the better way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I saw we both responded to a rather lengthy post on Twitter the other day from someone named Artem Zakharchenko. And we both seem to have some thoughts on this post. So maybe we can step through it here. I've got it up here and can sort of, we can step through it piece by piece. He starts by telling us that he's about to tell us the truth about TDD, which he goes with test-driven development. And I'm always curious to see whether people go with test-driven design or test-driven development. I know the latter is more popular, but some people are really, really like the former, they feel it describes what it is a little better. Mm-hmm. But he goes on to say, it's a broken practice. It always, it's always been broken. It's broken by the definition of it. Its biggest merit is the encouragement of testing, but that's where it ends, which is, that's a bold statement. What do you think about that?
So the funny thing is, I mean, okay, first of all, I know it, like, it's Twitter or X or whatever, and in general, you know, social media, you're trying to say something controversial. There's not a lot of point in being like, you know, the sky is blue, everybody, you know, like,
he's trying to sell his program down there. He's an educator of some kind, so he's trying to sell his courses.
Yeah, exactly. But the funny thing was that it really the first thing was, literally, I saw that and I was like, this reminds me of the stuff that Jared and I have been talking about that we keep saying we want to get deeper into, right? Because yeah, it really, for me, what it's the sort of resonation that I got from it was, and you bring up the design part. I think that's a big part of it, is so many times what I've tried to explain to people is the reason they have trouble with TDD, a very common one, is they got so used to doing, I experiment with the code, and then once it's all, like, you know, ready to be wrapped up in a bow, I write tests to prove that I got it right. And then when you do that, you know, there's a few things that happen. One is that you do end up, your tests feel more awkward to write because you have to do this whole long writing a test thing after. Mm-hmm. And your code is probably not, like, hasn't really been designed around testability to begin with. And so you perceive testing as like, oh, it's this long, drawn out, like, annoying thing. Oh, imagine having to do that before I write the code. That would just be such a big obstacle.
Yeah.
And of course, it's not it.
Yeah, I mean, so he goes on to say, to suggest that TDD heavily implies that you should know how the system behaves before even implementing it. He says most of the time you don't. All the developers I know don't know that ahead of time. In fact, I can spend days experimenting, writing an MVP until I even begin to grasp what parts of my system should be and what I expect from them. Mm-hmm. And I mean, my initial issue with that's, I mean, I have issues with a bunch of what he said. It's long. We're only a quarter of the way into it here, but what he's implying here is that, that you have to do TDD instead of, say, experimenting. That it's like, oh, I don't know what I'm building well enough to do TDD now, so I'm so TDD has failed me. And I think that's something that I really like the book Growing Object-Oriented Software Guided by Tests, and they're super super upfront in this book that, like, TDD is not everything. It does not replace all of your other design tools. It doesn't, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't replace your exploratory work. I know there's people that like to do sort of exploratory testing. That's its own thing. Mm-hmm. But you don't have to use TDD for everything. And I don't think that even the real TDD zealots are telling you that you have to do that, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so there's a few things there. I mean, one of them is the fact that I think a good thing for everybody to learn about software in general is, you know, ideologies and methodologies come and go. And I think it's very good to dive deep into them and to be like, okay, this feels really uncomfortable. Why don't I do it too hard for a bit? And then when I back off, I'll have a better sense of like what the right amount of this is, right? Which also, by the way, that's kind of a reference to also the spirit of extreme programming. And you and I have talked about extreme programming at some point, but
yeah.
So that's part of it is that as a methodology, like you're saying, like you're basically pointing out that it's a tool in your toolbox. So that's part of it. Like I mean, I'm not by any stretch of the imagination the most like hardcore TDD. Like I will, you know, like I wake up in the morning and I write a test before I like get out of bed, right? Like, you know, like I'm not the extremist in that way. But it's definitely in the same way that I found myself moving towards functional programming for similar reasons. Honestly, because I found testability was better the more code I wrote that was functional, like, you know, declarative, essentially, the easier it was to test. And so I started to move towards that. So thing number one, like you say, there are many design tools. TDD can help with parts of the design, doesn't help with all. I've had kind of like arguments with people about making, you know, like designing algorithms. And, you know, some people are like, oh, yeah, design the algorithm using TDD. I'm like, no.
Yeah, it doesn't fit those situations, and it also doesn't necessarily always give you a path forward. I think the Goosebook, I think they pull out CRC cards at some point as a design tool to get them through some step of the design, which seems honestly archaic given the sort of more modern tools we use, but. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just not something that's fashionable these days. If you're doing object-oriented design, sure, you can do CRC cards if you want. And if it helps you solve a problem, then it's a perfectly useful tool.
I like to do REPL stuff. I love languages that have a good REPL. You know, Ruby, you know, is one of them. It's one of the things that I was, you know, I don't think I would have been able to get as much on board with Elixir if it didn't have, you know, a REPL that I enjoyed working in. You know, I mean, I'm kind of a command line, you know, terminal guy to begin with. And so, you know, maybe that's a historical thing or whatever. But yeah, so I find that ability to experiment is really valuable. So I don't want to give that up. But the key insight for me, like I had kind of a journey with this, which was I first encountered TDD as a concept in university. I had this prof I really enjoyed him when he was teaching microcontrollers. And then he taught one semester of like a first year, like C++ class or whatever. And it was all about like testing first. And he was like really obsessed with this. I can't even remember which prof it was. But he was really obsessed with it. And I was like, oh, this is so dumb. I've never done that. I've been coding for years. Like it would take the fun away. That was my impression at the time. And so I kind of, you know, bounced around in my head for a while. And then through extreme programming at one of my earliest tech jobs I had, I was exposed to this idea of TDD, like as a practice rather than like sort of this theoretical thing. And, you know, I started to warm up to it, but I still had that mentality of like, you know, like you just check, like you write the code and you keep checking until it's right. And then it's not going to like stop being wrong tomorrow, right? Well, no, like not if you're writing all your code on your own, but as soon as you're writing code in a team, you know, and so then that started to lead into like, for me, my journey was when I was doing a lot of solo dev work. The irony was very often I'd you know, work on a bit of a project, leave it for, you know, like weeks, months, even come back to it and being like, crap, I need to like change this feature in, you know, an hour and a half. I don't even remember what I was thinking when I wrote this. Like, I don't remember what the edge cases were, what the things I was worried about were. So I started doing more and more TDD. And it started off by just writing more tests. And then I was like, oh, you know what? I'm going to start doing the TDD thing. I'll start writing them first. And it was funny how it just completely, you know, it turned me around over the years. That's part of that journey is, some of the context there is I started to realize, this is where I warmed up emotionally to it. Like that was the practical reason, but I warmed up emotionally to it when I realized that when I was a kid, the way that I wrote games, right? Which is, you know, what do you write when you're a kid? You write games.
That's what I wrote.
Right? Exactly, right? And so, you know, when I was writing games, this was in the 80s. I had no idea what I was doing. The books, you know, there were like, you know, five dialects of BASIC, and, you know, the first book I had was the wrong one for the computer, and it was like a mess, right? So it was, I had to do a lot of like trial and error stuff. And what I realized was that the way that I coded was being like, I don't know how to do the whole thing. I wonder if I could do like this one little piece. Like, you know, I want to, you know, you start off, you're like, okay, I just want like the, you know, my player to move around. Okay, can I do that? And then I'd write a totally separate piece, which would be like the bad guy moving around, because some of the logic was the same, but some of it was different because it had to have some logic for, you know, choosing how to move. And then, you know, maybe I'd have like multiple bad guys, some of them move around more randomly and some of them try to chase you and that kind of stuff, right? And so what I realized is I would, you know, try to write that little piece and then keep checking until it looked like it was right. And then I'd do that with a bunch of pieces and then I'd tie them together. And the boring part is the constant checking, right? Like it's that feeling of like, oh, did I have an off by one there? You know? And so gradually the emotional part of, oh, I wrote the tests and I have to say the big thing is watchers. Having a test watcher.
Okay.
It's a game changer. It's a game changer in the sense that now you've got something kind of like, you know, like certain things you can have in your IDE. I mean, like I'm a NeoVim lover, but you know, I still have some of that stuff, right?
Yeah.
But that fact of like, I write the code and literally as soon as that, you know, that file is saved, it triggers like running the test on it. I found that was huge because then I'd be like, oh no, I screwed something up. Oh, boom. Cool. Okay. Let's move on to the next stage. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I very similar feelings there though. I honestly, I'm a manual test runner. Don't know how I ended up like this. The tooling in Ruby for auto test running it's been not always super well maintained, and I kind of fell off of it and am now in one of those people who command tabs over and up enter to run the tests.
I did that for years. I discovered, honestly, I don't think I actually did test like watcher runners until I was doing some stuff in JavaScript and I was working with Jest and I was like, wow. Like yeah, I loved really nice. Jest. Yeah. And so that was one of the first things when I moved to Elixir. I was immediately like, oh, like what is there that does the same thing? And there's a couple. One of them I think is test.watch, and then there's a newer one that I use now called test.interactive. And it's basically like explicitly, you know, like not exactly a clone, but it's based on Jest. And so it's got a lot of the same stuff, but yeah, like it's not necessary, but I found it was like a big upgrade because all of a sudden you've got this immediate feedback.
Yeah. And like feedback is one of those things that I honestly think that the thing that still ties together all the agile methodologies is that idea of feedback. And I think it's almost most present in methodologies like XP where it's, you know, you use your test to get feedback on the code itself. You use the meeting structure, limited as it is, to get feedback on the ongoing work and client mm-hmm. feedback. And then you loop that into, you know, whether you're doing like quarterly planning, and it's just a bunch of it's just a bunch of concentric feedback loops, and it feels bizarre if you're ever missing one of those. Like it feels wrong to me it feels like you're out on a limb somewhere if you're missing any of them.
Yeah, definitely. And I still want to kind of like, not jump into the XP thing maybe too quickly, but like it's definitely the thing that was interesting to me was being in computer science and learning about this, the waterfall method and all this stuff and like these different methodologies. And it was so funny to me because having grown up programming, we didn't even like, we just called it coding, but what we did was agile inherently. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of doing something another way, like it was almost weird to have like a name for what we did other than, I just code. Like I test the thing, see if it's getting closer. And, like that sense of gradually getting closer to what you're building, whether you're building it for yourself or other people or whatever, it just felt like the normal way to do things because we're not building bridges where we have to have all the plans before we make them.
Yeah.
Which is also funny because my dad's an architect and he and I have talked about that, like the contrast, the compare and contrast. So there are some things that are very similar and some things that are very different. Like when you're building a bridge, or a hospital or something, important like that, there's a lot you have to get up, get right up front. And even then, incidentally, my dad talked about, because he built hospitals. One of the things he talked about was moving as much as possible to flexible reuse of rooms, like trying to have ways where, you could, depending on the demand for one thing or another, change the use of a room, which was kind of like an innovative thing. So even in architecture, they're trying to be more agile.
Yeah, I mean that speaks to this the sort of basic idea that's behind the styles of TDD that I practice, which is that the whole practice is designed to around decoupling objects, making it so that a given piece of the system can be moved around, used somewhere else, employed in different ways. Mm-hmm. I know some people. What are your thoughts on? So when I bring that up, sometimes people get mad about the idea of code reuse. And there are some really good articles about how code reuse is actually a myth. I find them hard to believe because I've reused code before. But what are your thoughts on that idea?
When you really look at what we do, we build abstractions to solve problems that are, like abstractions of the problem and abstractions of the hardware, right? And, code reuse, like it depends on what you mean. You can take something that you're using and say, hey, I think I could probably abstract this into like a library function, right? So that's one way. And there's obviously copy and paste. And the funny thing is that people hate the copy and paste thing. It's rightly, people were doing too much of it, and so it rightly became like a thing that is unpopular. But I think there's two contexts, right? Like people talk about the rule of three. Like if you copy and paste once, that's fine. But once you've got three copies, you should probably say like maybe there's a common thing to factor out. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that functional programming has made me more sensitive to is really focusing on the semantics. Right? Like really thinking, like when you're thinking, making declarative code, you're thinking about like, what does this code mean? And that's something I'm really trying to think about, which even gets into the whole question of like, how do you, like how many comments are too many or too few, right? And so the more declarative the code feels, the easier it is to be like, okay, so we're defining our terms here. We've made a bunch of definitions and then we use them, right? And so I think one of the things that really hit me was the realization of like, when you're copying and pasting, sometimes similarities are a coincidence.
Yeah.
Meaning that I don't know what this object and this object, or these classes or modules are going to look like in the future. And I say object, like even in Elixir, they're called structs. But I think the word, just as a passing note, I think the word object is a good general term, whether it's a C struct or a, like Rust or whatever, it doesn't really matter. Like a thing of, like a piece of data, right? And so the thing is, when you don't know if the similarities have any reason to persist, because they're not there for a reason that they're not conceptually coupled. I think that's really the key. That's really what it is, right? So, you know, when there isn't some coherent reason why they would always have to change together, copying and pasting is absolutely the correct decision. Like, there's not even a question, right?
Yeah. Dan Abramov actually has a really good talk from Deconstruct 1 year about that topic exactly, and how the, you know, dry often gets misconstrued, how the topic is, the fundamental idea behind dry is you should have a single authoritative representation of any piece of information in your system. And just because two things, pieces of code look the same, doesn't mean they're representative of the same, you know, piece of information, piece of business logic, whatever it happens to be. And that's, I feel like that's one of the ways that a lot of automated code analysis tools fall over is they're like, oh, you got similar code here. And it's like, that's fine. Oh. I know.
That's a really interesting point about the automated code thing. And that's, it's, I mean, that even leads us, you know, into the questions of like the role of AI in the future, which is that, you know, I think for the foreseeable future, AI is going to be better at acting as a, like a tool for us to oversee. And, you know, yeah, I mean, I don't even know if that's necessarily such a worthwhile discussion at this point. I think the smart money is on, like, you know, when you've shown me a year's worth of, you know, leaving, you know, an AI tool to just be a programmer with no supervision, we'll talk, you know, like, yeah. So, but, you know, that's the problem with these tools is that, like, when you're talking about semantics, as opposed to, you know, the content, you know, that, like, the example of, like, lots of things have names and addresses. Some of them are people, some of them are companies, you know, like, there may be some things that are in common. You might be able to factor something out there, but you can't necessarily assume that because they look similar or even the same, like they might look identical in the moment. I've got a specific moment in mind where I had someone do a code review where they commented on that and they were like, oh, like it seems bizarre that, you know, that you're not like reusing this object. And I'm like, yeah, but they're semantically not the same. Like they're the meaning of what this thing is. It's just coincidence that at this point, the information we know about what we want to put in those objects, it happens to be the same. We don't know if that's going to change in the future because they're not actually, you know, they're not coupled.
Yeah, and you can even come at it from the perspective of SRP as well. Like you can say that, you know, if this thing should have one reason to change, if I reuse it for this other purpose, suddenly it could potentially have, you know, different changes in the domain or our understanding of it, different pieces of that domain could impact how this object needs to behave independently. And it's like, oh, then we're not dealing with the same thing. This is bad code reuse.
Yeah, exactly. It's one of those things where you kind of come around over time to like, I just don't know. Like I recognize that I don't know, you know? And so, you know, being a little bit slow to abstract away common things is good. And then you also have to recognize, like, I'm probably going to get it wrong sometimes. There are probably going to be times when, you know, I factor something out and later on I'm like, oh man, oh no, I was wrong. Like these are actually different, you know, and, you know, what can you do?
Yeah. And you brought up the rule of three. I think that's, right. It's sort of an interesting piece of advice because it's not terrible advice. It's one of those things that's almost never the right answer. Like it's a rule of thumb, which is fine. It's good. But I almost think it's more valuable as giving people permission to avoid premature refactoring. You know, saying, okay, I'll wait till I have more information. Waiting till you have three is arbitrary, but fine if that's how long you want to wait. If you feel at that point that you're confident in in refactoring or not, then you can make that decision there, or you can just wait. You can just keep waiting.
Well, and it's tricky too, because, you know, like I've gone all over the place with things like, you know, how long a function should be. And, you know, like I, you know, you and I both did C programming pretty early on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there have been some legendarily long C functions that have been written, right? So the common thing was just to be like, oh, it has to do a thing. Okay, we'll just shove all the logic we need to do in there. And then, you know, and then gradually, you know, it became more fashionable to break things up. But, you know, so for a long time, I knew people, and I was actually pushing back on this for a while. I had, you know, coders that would tell me like, oh yeah, you know, a function should be like, you know, only a couple of lines and very, very specific. And I was like, it really depends. There are situations, especially when you're dealing with an algorithm, where you want to see the whole algorithm in one shot, right? But then that gets into this other thing of like, well, what does that even mean? Because if I can abstract away a step of that algorithm in a way that doesn't make you go like, oh, I don't know what, like, it's, you don't want to have a situation where you got like the algorithm, you know, you go down through the lines and then you reach this point where you're like, I don't know what this means, you know. But if you've got something really simple, I mean, the silly example would be, you know, if you're printing logs or something and at some point it like does the printing, you want the printing to be a function, right? Like you wouldn't want to be, mm-hmm. you know, like open file handle and, you know, like all that kind of stuff, right? So the things that are extraneous to the focus of the function, like we come back to the SRP sort of theme, right? But what's interesting about that is that as a result, I actually do find that sometimes having a private function that's only used by the other function is the right choice, right? Like if you've got like, oh, you know, like three times, you know, I'm doing this thing. Well, you know, like sometimes it just makes the code easier to read where you're like, oh yeah, blah, 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 the thing, blah, blah, blah. You know, like you don't have to reread that section of code that would have otherwise been basically the same. And that can be an advantage. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
So something I think that's relevant to this conversation, I seem to recall that you're more of a fan of like the London style TDD, right?
Yes. Yes, I am.
But also I think that having that choice, like being able to think top down and bottom up, is a big part of the freedom that makes it easier to do TDD. And the reason why I'll say that is if you're starting off with a spec, I think that top down is much easier to do. Because you're like, I know what the outside needs to look like, you know, so I can spec it out and make the outside look like what it needs to be. And then I can gradually drill down through the code and make the code do the thing that it's supposed to, right?
Yeah.
But there are other times, and this is where I think a lot of people misunderstand it. If you're trying to figure out, you know, you don't even know what the spec should be, and maybe you don't even understand the technology yet. Maybe it's a new, I know, some new internet service or something, and you haven't quite figured out how you want to use it. I think of that as like the Lego block method. So like I'll write some Lego blocks that play with the thing, you know, like maybe like a wrapper around an API or whatever it is. And sure. Gradually like wrap my head around like how to use this thing. And then maybe that starts to form, you know, upwards and outwards instead of the other way down.
Right. Yeah. So you feel that you still use tests in that situation?
Yeah. And this is kind of what I'm getting at is that if what you say is, I don't quite know, let's say, you know, I'm trying to imagine like a new technology, you know, the blah, blah technology, that I've never used before. Very, very new. There isn't a lot of precedent for how to use it. I want to play with it. And I've got a sense that it might be the right way to solve some technical problem that we have. Right. And so, you know, maybe I start by, you know, specking out like a wrapper around it. And I've got some, let's say I've got a sense of what I want to accomplish. But I don't know exactly what the interface should look like. I don't know exactly what the end result should be. The type of thing, the prototyping that our good friend, I can't remember his Twitter handle, but you've got...
Oh, Artem.
Yeah, Artem, right. So I think, you know, the perspective that he was representing, I think is the perspective of a lot of people who don't realize if you want to prototype something out, you can do it top down or down up with TDD as well. If you're not sure what the interface should look like, well, you could just play with the interface and not even write any of the actual code, right? So you could just, you know, build out like interfaces that don't really do anything, but get a sense of that. And then the other side is when you're getting to know a new technology, you can write unit tests and be like, it's hard to think of like really good examples without going too deep into like specific projects I've done, but you get what I mean. It's like, you know, maybe you can
validate your assumptions about them.
Yeah.
Getting at?
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of it for me is just you're writing tests to automate the process that you would do manually of checking. Like in the REPL, I might, you know, maybe I would like write the function and then go into the REPL, you know, reload the module and like run some tests. Well, why wouldn't the computer do that for me? Mm-hmm. Right? So that's all I'm saying is like sometimes building from the ground up helps you get to know the thing you're working with.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm 100% with you. I treat the sort of outside in London style TDD that I do as a default way of working. But if I'm encountering a significant uncertainty around anything, I'm happy to go pay down that uncertainty in whatever way makes sense. You know, sometimes that's exactly what you're describing. But again, I'm also, if I'm using an API, I'll often even skip the whole testing anything, and I'll just be doing stuff in my shell, and I'll just hit it with my HTTP client or whatever it is, if it's an HTTP API, and you know, it's super repeatable. I can run it fast. I've got fast shell search, so I can rerun commands whenever I need to test things out. And that kind of exploration is still totally valuable to me. It's not I think one of the things from Artem's post is he says the negative aspect of TDD is that I've seen teams discouraged if they fail to follow it. And so they give up on the whole idea of testing since TDD is so universally associated with it. Instead of encouraging people to test and showing them that testing software can be fun, the practice locks them in pedantic constraints that no engineer can follow. And I don't know who he's talking about there's nobody out there who's like, you have to do TDD all the time, exactly this way. Like if you could, you know, none of the books say that, none of them.
Well, so I mean, I would say that, I mean, there's some validity in the sense that, you know, I mean, I can point to some people. I've seen some conference talks where people have basically said, I can't remember who it was. I remember one guy basically saying like, listen, if you're not doing TDD, you're not a truly professional programmer. Okay, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that goes too far. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, we were talking about like extreme programming as a methodology, and a big part of extreme programming, I mean, literally the reason why it was called extreme is they looked across the industry at these emerging agile practices with smaller software shops. And it's good to remember that, you know, even in the early 90s, the concept of like a small software shop was kind of a new concept, right? You know, you'd added all these sort of large companies that wrote software, and, you know, so they were looking at these emerging agile practices and basically said, a lot of people are doing a few of these, like 70% or 50%. They're doing it some of the time. You know, they do some pair programming. They find that useful. You know, they try to write some tests, and, you know, they find that often if they write the test first, that's good. It was kind of like, and so there was this idea in extreme programming of like, we're going to turn it up to 11, you know, yeah. Like do everything extreme, extreme, extreme. And so, you know, like, yeah, I can see if you talk to certain people, they might push it, you know, a little bit too sort of like crazy. But yeah, like, you know, you're talking about the REPL thing, and part of it is it comes back to the tool thing. So one of the things that I often do is I'll often have like, I'll do something in the REPL and I'll be like, oh, this is good. Maybe I'll just copy this code into a module or whatever. And I'll, you know, it'll evolve that way. When I'm working with an API, something I've often done is I'll write a 1 or 2 line bash script that runs curl, right? And maybe sure. it runs curl and then pipes it through, you know, sed or whatever it is. And sometimes that's literally just the fastest way. Because really, the thing you brought into focus, I think, is a really key point. It's more about the feedback, like getting quick feedback on ideas and approaches. It's always about that. And yeah. So TDD is a tool to accomplish that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, there are other merits, you know, the outside in style has its heavy focus on the, what the actual outcome is for users. You're discouraged from gold plating and that kind of thing. But at the end of the day, the feedback is always seems to be with most of the sort of the lightweight methodologies, feedback seems to be at the core of them in some way, and they focus on them in different ways. What's your position on test doubles and mocks in particular?
You know, I actually want to open by confessing that I have relearned and relearned like the differences the differences in definitions that people often use for doubles and mocks and what are the other ones? And
spies,
I constantly
spies,
yeah, stubs, exactly. And to be honest, like I constantly forget what exactly, you know, like if I really think about it, I can sort of remember, but it's a really interesting thing because this also ties into the other topic of like why I went into what drew me into functional programming was in large part that I wanted to reduce the use of mocks. So that was definitely a motivating factor, was the realization that I wanted as much as possible of my code to be, you know, pure functions that didn't have these, you know, dependencies on, you know, like on states and on, you know, on mutation in particular. And so the idea of trying to move, to the outside, all of the, you know, mutation and dirty outside world type stuff increasingly started to make sense, which was weird because in the beginning, I found it so hard to understand. I was like, wait, isn't literally all the cool stuff we do mutating the world, you know, like literally like, that was also like a big change for me. But in terms of mocks, I mean, let's say there are a few different things. I think it's just that you've got the difficulty of keeping the mock in sync with whatever it's mocking. Sure. And you've got the difficulty, which is also, you know, you've got different problems with depending on whether you own the thing that's being mocked or don't. And then the question of whether, you know, like at what boundary of the system do you start using mocks? You know, so if you've got a system, like, are you mocking your internal system objects, or are you only mocking external objects? If you are, you know, like, where do you define the boundaries of the unit and so on? It's I think it's the combination of the fact that, you know, maybe this is my version of the TDD slows you down. You know, it's like, oh, like writing mocks, you know, slows you down, and it's I find that I associate with it with a lot of friction. I think that's really what it is. I associate with a lot of friction and a lot of, oh crap, like the mock is out of sync with this thing, or this mocking tool hid a bug that we weren't able to see. So someone made a change to some code somewhere and the mock didn't cover that, you know, that change. So instead it covered it up. So I've kind of had these negative, experiences with them. I've got some thoughts on that, but I first want to hear your thoughts also on mocking and doubles, because it might be very different.
Sure. Yeah. No, I use them. I wouldn't say like I'm not heading out to use them as much as possible or anything, but I try to use when I'm writing object-oriented code, I use them very heavily to isolate the different units of my system, because I end up building systems where I'm integration testing at the sort of outside entry point layers to the system. I build web applications, so that's usually request or controller tests, as well as background job tests. Those ones I tend to integration test as much as possible, so that all of the pieces are plugged in. I treat them sort of as a composition layer. I'm passing objects to other objects to try and build up whatever functionality I'm trying to get to at that layer, and trying to trust the tests at that layer to make sure that all of that is plugged in a way that works, without testing too much of the details of the outcome, just making sure that it broadly does whatever it says it does. And then the individual objects that I'm composing at that layer, I'm unit testing, and whatever collaborators they have at that point in those unit tests, I'm mocking all of those out. So I am still covering everything, in that all of the pieces still are tested in conjunction, but the permutations are all tested in isolation with mocks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. How do you find you strategize around keeping the mocks in sync with other code changes?
I mean, usually those integration tests are going to fail if I make a change somewhere that wouldn't be detected. We have limited tools in Ruby for it. I use instance double where I can, because that will ensure that you only call methods that actually exist on the objects. We don't have the safety of a type system where you can actually implement the same your mocks can implement the same interfaces as your production code, and then you are guaranteed to get the same types of return types, even if it doesn't necessarily adhere to the same full, more broad contract. Mm-hmm. I honestly just haven't found it to be a painful part of developing software myself, possibly just because I always have those integration tests, if at all possible. So that always sort of acts as a safety net, where if I make a change somewhere to some object and fail to make it in the corresponding places, it's usually the integration test is going to fail, and then I'm going to realize the issue and have to go hunting for where the inconsistency is.
Well, more and more I started to realize that I liked the idea. Like, for example, if you're talking about, mocking out external things, like external modules or whatever, I really increasingly like the idea that in an ideal world, if you're building the type of module that someone, let's say you're building a module that interfaces with AWS, like I can't remember what Ruby has for that, but yeah.
8,000 AWS SDK gems, the one for each service.
Yeah, no, exactly. I have a vague memory of that, but so in an ideal world, I like the idea of some kind of a mock basically being able to represent that without, just something that lets you go through the motions of what you would be doing without actually having to, hit the service. In particular, because if you're writing that gem, for example, you become responsible for keeping up to date with API changes and stuff. And so it makes sense for the changes to the mock to actually happen in sync with that, right? So,
yeah, I guess that's something I didn't necessarily touch on in my explanation, was something that you brought up, which was, are we mocking code we own or not? And
right.
I tend to subscribe to the Nat Price Steve Freeman philosophy on that, which is you don't mock out classes you don't own. As much as possible, what you do is you write wrappers for them, and then you mock out your wrappers. Your wrappers themselves should be integration tested, in that the tests for them aren't really unit tests. they should call the external API, and you should make sure that that connection all works so that you can have sort of the full connection through of, I made this object, it interacts with this third-party API or whatever it is, I've got tests that verify that it does that correctly. If something changes there, hopefully those tests should fail. Now I can take my wrapper thing and have some sort of avenue for mocking it out, as well as if one of the other things that comes up is, you know, mocks aren't the only kind of test double. Potentially you need to be able to interact with that third-party service, or potentially you can't always interact with that third-party service in all of your tests. That gives you an avenue to introduce whichever one of the other kinds of test doubles is the one where it's a fake implementation. It's not a verifying one. It's just a fake implementation so that you can essentially step out that API in certain contexts or in development or wherever you need to. It gives you that sort of ability to use whatever features make sense for your language, polymorphism or whatever, to avoid making calls to systems that you're not allowed to make calls to, because sadly not everyone gives you a test environment to hit.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and then, you know, you end up with all kinds of other issues. Yeah, I mean, that whole thing of, you know, there's benefits to having, you know, integration testing that goes all the way to, you know, like hitting the, you know, the test API and all that kind of stuff. Like it's nice, but I know, I feel like with all these things, I just kind of go back and forth, you know, like in one situation, I came into a code base that had, you know, where there were a bunch of things that were literally just, yeah, like they were just hitting the network every time the tests were run. And at the time I found that, to be honest, like kind of horrifying. I was like, oh man, that's, but you know, there's an advantage, which is, well, you know, it literally actually works. It literally does the thing, you know, so you wouldn't want, I mean, it would not, by definition, that's not a unit test, but as an integration test, there's a good case to be made for it. But it's tricky because you also, like you say, you have to go with the things that your language supports. So, you know, in some situations, having something that's mocked out, like it's funny, because I was saying that I really like the idea of when you're providing a module that interfaces with an external service, like, you know, an AWS wrapper or a whatever wrapper. If you're providing that module, I do like the idea of, and I'm gonna support both sides of this actually, right? Like, I like on the one hand the idea that you also provide like a default mock that essentially does the normal things but doesn't hit the network. I like the idea of that.
A no-op version.
Yeah, but even something that might have like a light amount of, you know, like let's say you upload some data to a bucket, and then when you download that little piece of data, it's, you know, the mock actually gives it back to you. So like a, you know, like you said, I guess that would be, I think that's more of like a double than a stub, but I keep forgetting which one's which.
Yeah, whichever one it is. The implementation for testing purposes one.
Yeah, exactly. But the other point is valid too, which is, it's nice if your system is wrapping all of those modules, right? But then you get all these other issues, which is like, well, okay, the purpose of having a wrapper around that service is so that people don't have to mess with that too much, right? So if you're writing a wrapper around the service, it's like, you know.
Yeah, you can also make judgment calls. You know, I have one application that we work on where there's a module that integrates with an FTP server, and
right.
We kind of just trust that FTP is not going to change. There's not really any tests around it. It's like FTP is not changing. It was implemented. It has never changed. There's a test file with no tests in it that says, this is probably never going to change. If it does, we should probably find a better, some kind of reasonable way to test it. And it's never changed. Yeah. It's never broken. It just sits there. It's fine.
You know, I think that this is actually, this is a really important contribution to this this discussion, because part of what I think is valuable is talking about what we don't test. Mm-hmm. You know, so like I get that. Like, why would you test that the FTP, you know, service and module and whatever that has worked for a million years, why is that going to be broken tomorrow? Right? Like it's just not worth your time. You know, like it doesn't make sense to test that. And then that leads me to something that is, you know, that I've often been kind of shy about, but I'm going to say more openly, which is that I don't tend to test front end code.
Yeah.
And no, but to be clear, I like to have integration tests that will go all the way to the front end. But the front end code itself.
When you say integration tests, you're saying like, you mean like browser driving, that kind of thing?
Or, I mean, yeah, it depends on the context. Like if you're talking about, you know, like, you know, sort of old school, you know, Rails and for example, and like there are live view tests for within Elixir's Phoenix, where, you know, you're doing front end code from the back end, which it, by the way, that's a whole other testing situation we could maybe talk about. But yeah, all I'm saying is like end to end testing. Test some basic things like, and to be honest, I would just be testing things like the number shows up, you know, like it shows the name of, you know, like the username or what, you know, like really basic stuff. And the reason, like, I'd be curious about your thoughts on it. But my thought is when you're writing front end code, you're constantly in the browser. You have to be constantly eyeballing it. Oh, is the font too small? Oh, is it shifted over or whatever? So it doesn't make sense to automate something where you always have to eyeball it, you know? So.
Yeah, we typically don't write exhaustive acceptance tests. We do write a lot of them and try to cover major features with them. Working in e-commerce, it's a bit of an interesting one. So a lot of what we do, we really, our tests are weighted very heavily towards the most important things on the website. So the bulk of things, you know, the user's address, edit page in their settings is going to have, you know, at most a single test covering it. Whereas the core flow of going through all the different various variations of the product page and then checking out with all of the different payment methods that we're able to run in acceptance tests. Those are very exhaustively tested because that is our bottom line. And that comes out of not even really a design philosophy, but it's more the very base tests need to give you confidence that the thing you're pushing out works. And we need that to make changes once, if the checkout's reasonably complex, we just need that level of confidence.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. I think, you know, maybe a way of, cause you really brought up the central theme, which is you test the things that have the most business value. And, you know, I would say, like, I'm not going to test whether the background of something is the right color. You know, just I'm sort of going to the extreme end of, like, you know, something that you wouldn't test. But do you want to test that, you know, when you change the value of, you know, let's say the price of an item in like, you know, in your web store, that it does successfully change? Yeah, you probably want to make sure that that's tested, right? You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, so, and it's also understanding the difference between, you know, like what the back end should be doing versus the front end, right? But mostly it was just the realization that for a lot of stuff, you know, when I say I don't, like, I've written front end tests. Like, I'm not trying to say I never do them. But it's mostly what I'm saying is exactly that. Like, I'm not trying. There are a lot of things that are part of the UI experience that are not tested. That's kind of what I'm getting at.
Yeah, that actually, I've talked about this before. I think that I work with a lot of teams that have QA within their team in some capacity. And the thing I try to really stress on these teams is that QA is like orthogonal to acceptance testing. There are things that our automated acceptance tests can test way faster than the QA people can. And it can run through a whole bunch, like a huge list of these things before a real human has finished the first one. But there are things that are really, really hard to test in automated tests, or just really impractical, painful to test. And that's where QA is really, really good. It's really, really good at the catching visual regressions and UI issues and these kinds of things that are impractical for the acceptance test. So you need to have a strategy of these are the kinds of things we test in acceptance tests. These are the kinds of things we ask QA to do for us. They complement each other. They're not, one is not a replacement for the other.
Yeah, I find that part really interesting. And you've got I can't remember their names, but there are a number of like professional testers out there who've talked about the difference between true testing, which is what most of us call like, you know, exploratory testing, versus what they call, you know, what we usually call like automated tests, they call automated checking. I think there's some validity to making that distinction, saying that like truly testing something means you're like putting it through its paces and trying to break it. Whereas like the things we call automated tests are really just verifying that the things we've already, you know, realized might be a problem have not come back to bite us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, definitely more of a verification process.
Yeah, for sure. But it's interesting though, because part of what's interesting to me about the QA thing is, you know, you get into things like, you know, iterations, like the pacing, the feedback loop. And it's interesting how to fit that in, you know, like if you're doing continuous integration, you know, it might be tricky for the QA to keep up with the pace of like, oh yeah, you know, we released like 15 times today, you know, I hope you kept pace with all of that, right? Like,
yeah, you went through all your scripts 15 times today, right?
Right. Yeah, so it's a little tricky. So
yeah, we've seen that pain for sure.
Part of what was interesting for me working in Phoenix LiveView, and I mostly worked more back end with Phoenix. Phoenix being the Elixir, I think it's pretty well known by now, but it's still pretty niche. Phoenix being the Elixir, essentially, like if we're totally honest, it's sort of mostly inspired by Rails, and also, in my opinion, like Express. Like it reminds me in some ways it reminds me of Express in some ways too. And one of the things that's become sort of like a flagship feature has been LiveView, which, you know, like Rails has, what's it called? I think it was called Turbo. Hotwire for a while, and Turbo.
Oh, yeah.
Part of what was interesting for me with the testing on that side is that if you have more decoupling of the front end from the back end, where, you know, you've got a clear boundary of like, okay, the back end provides this API, and we know if we've made a change to that API that's incompatible. I mean, ideally, we're doing it in a way where the front end team can catch up before we, you know, deprecate and remove something, you know. But one of the things that definitely, you know, it sort of bit me in the ass a couple of times was I wasn't doing so much of the LiveView front end stuff, and on a project where there was a fair bit of LiveView, there were a couple of times when I changed something in the fully in the back end, and there weren't enough tests for the live view front end. And so there were things that got missed. And so that actually changed some of my perspective on some of the testing, where I'm like, well, in that context where it's, in my opinion, it shouldn't have been so tightly coupled. Like that was an issue. But it was a good reminder. Like for one thing, even if they're both server side, like even if you're doing your front end from the server side, you still need to have a certain amount of decoupling. Like you have to be careful not to get lazy and allow some of that to bleed in. But then it also led into the question of like, oh, well, maybe, you know, maybe as a result, you kind of have to be more careful with some of your testing, because of the fact that it's easier to have that kind of a mistake, like a mistake that wouldn't happen as easily. Like you would be really conscious of like, oh, I changed the API that's exposed, let's say the GraphQL API of the back end. That's a big deal. That's like, you know, the sirens are blaring and stuff, right? Whereas when it's all on the back end side, so I just thought it was an interesting thing. There was a discovery of working in LiveView that I, you know, wasn't as familiar with. So.
Yeah. So I know you have some experience with Ruby stuff. Would you liken this to sort of the issues with the sort of default approach in Rails of using database models sort of directly in the views? Like you see controllers focused right around the database models used directly in the views, and changes potentially to only the schema can then impact your front end views in ways that might not be tested, might not be handled.
100% It's exactly that. And it's kind of that, and in some ways better and in some ways worse. The better part is that the Phoenix approach wraps around Ecto, and Ecto is basically like Ecto's, you know, I don't want to go too deep into that, but Ecto's kind of, I really wasn't sure if I liked it at first, and I'll just say that I grew to like it. It's essentially the choice of instead of using, you know, instead of using a what do you call it? You know, like in Rails, you know, like a model, you know, mapping, what's the word I'm trying to say?
Like active record.
Yeah. Active record. That's what I was trying to remember. It was just totally escaping me. Yeah. So anyways, instead of the active record model, Ecto essentially creates a DSL that makes SQL look like Elixir, which is a bit of a mouthful, but it's a really interesting choice because it means that you're not like, it threw me through a loop. It was a little bit of an uncanny valley for a while, but the positive part was once I got used to the DSL, it really meant that I could somehow not have to like switch brains into, you know, SQL and then come back in. And I also didn't have the sort of leaky abstraction thing that you get with something like Active Record sometimes. So mm-hmm. There's some interesting stuff around how it handles this, like the repo pattern, which is good. And it offers a little bit more separation there. But what you absolutely have is the same thing of by default, a lot of things essentially expose the data model all the way through to like, you know, to essentially JavaScript, right? Like, so you've got, you know, this live, you know, sort of SPA style thing. That's all based on the model. And that was exactly the problem that we ran into. And there are solutions to it. And the solutions are essentially that you, I'm trying to translate this into, you know, not Elixir speak, but like,
sure. Yeah. Yeah.
But it's essentially like saying, what if we, what if, and again, like my Rails experience is a little bit limited, but instead of directly, you know, hooking up the model all the way to the front end, what if what we do is we've got a little bit of an intermediation layer. And so we essentially have a second object that takes the data from the back end and then exposes it as we want to the front end and does the interaction there. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, and that's a sort of popular, I don't know if I want to say it's popular. It's a not uncommon pattern you see in Rails applications these days where people will use some kind of view model layer, some kind of something that often wraps one of those database models or extracts data from it, and then that's passed to the front end. I've always been torn on that one because I appreciate the decoupling, but then I'm also, it's also kind of clunky to have that intermediate model when it, like that intermediate class when you don't necessarily otherwise need it. And so once you start needing, say, formatting logic or something like that in there, then it's like, okay, it makes sense for me to have this extra object rather than just have like a handful of helpers that are available everywhere or something like that. But it's without the other pieces, without a type system, it's like, how much more safety are you actually getting? It really depends on what you're doing with those values. But some people are doing some neat stuff with typed attributes in Ruby, that if you want to add that kind of safety to a certain layer of your system, you can. So it's an interesting space, trying to provide that a little bit of decoupling from that, from the database all the way through to the view.
Yeah, and so something that comes up in Elixir, which is, you know, it sort of ties back into the things I like about functional programming, is that you're, and I also, in fairness, I know that like .NET has some similar stuff, but we talk about change sets as sort of the way that we interact with the database, and so you're more thinking in terms of like these, you know, so you've got the change set interaction with the front end, and then the change set interaction with the database. And so that's where you can make some decisions, and you can sort of say like, oh, if I'm in the back end and I'm doing something and I know that everything's vetted, here's like, I'll actually use a different change set function that assumes the data is relatively safe. And then if I'm interacting with the user, there might be a bunch of things, including like virtual fields where you're like, yeah, the user doesn't want to have to know that this, you know, that there's like three different things that this could be, you know, so we'll expose it as one thing and then we'll do the translation later on or whatever. So it allows you to do like some clever things like that.
But yeah, I'm very jealous of that feature. I've not done anything meaningful with Ecto, but when I sort of was exploring it in the early Elixir days, I looked at that and was just like, oh man, I want that. But I'm also someone who, I work on a lot of projects that have a lot of different people working on them, and I'm not going to start doing weird stuff in my Rails apps just because I wish that I was writing Elixir that day.
I get that. It's a tricky thing. And, you know, as you said before, there's beautiful things about all these different languages. So, you know, you can't have all the things. I mean, one thing you could do is you could, in your copious free time, you could write like a Ruby version of Ecto, and then release it into the world, wait till, you know, a whole bunch of other people have used it on a whole bunch of other projects. And then you can be like, you know, now it's a best practice.
Yeah, no, I mean, to be fair, I think maybe Datamapper is a little more similar to Ecto in a bunch of different ways.
Right.
And I should probably go explore that, see what that sort of whole ecosystem is doing. I don't spend enough time over there. All right, to sum this up, we've talked about a whole bunch of different things, from TDD to XP to some fun stuff about mocks and various other aspects of the software we develop. I feel like we should tie it back to that original post we started with, and you can finally answer the question for us: is TDD fundamentally broken?
I think TDD is only broken when people approach it as a religion, you know, where they're too dogmatic about it, or if they view it, I think the biggest mistake that people make is when they view it as an obstacle to having a playful attitude towards the code rather than a companion, you know, like something that's there beside you as you're creating stuff. And so, so TDD itself isn't broken, but it's also not, it should be neither like, you know, shackles nor a holy grail, to totally mix metaphors.
Fair. All right. It has been a pleasure having you on the podcast. Where can people find you online if they liked the words that came out of your mouth and want to hear more of you?
Yeah, you can, if you don't like the words, you can send them to DevNull. No, I'm kidding. You can probably get in touch with me too. But yeah, so I'm ByronAlley.com is my web presence. And then I'm also on, you know, X/Twitter. And it's actually, I'm also the same thing on Mastodon.social. I'm on a bunch of different servers, and that was like one of the first ones I joined. So you can find me there, but if you just go to ByronAlley.com, you can find all the other stuff, I think.
Cool. Well, thanks, Byron.
Great. Thanks. Thanks for having me, Jared. This is fun as always.
All right. I hope everyone enjoyed that conversation with Byron. You'll find links to his online presence down below in the show notes. If you have encountered instances, conference talks, blog posts, whatever it is, that are trying to say that TDD is the one true, correct, and only way to build software, I was perhaps a little flippant in the interview where I said that nobody's saying that. I'd like to dive into instances of people saying that, since apparently they are out there. So if you have any examples, send them to me. Socials are down below. Message the podcast accounts or the personal accounts, DM me, whatever you want. Send them my way. I want to see what's out there. What people are saying on that along those lines and why. We'll have another episode. Got some fun guests lined up for the next one. So stay tuned for that. And in the meantime, go delete some.